Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
To the Socialist Insight. Today we have Bob Maskey. He's joining our program once again. He's been on the program several times discussing relevant issues relevant to a capitalist society and also how socialism could be able to make a society more workable and also give more freedom for working class people. Bob, again, I would like to welcome you to our program today.
Thanks for inviting me, Stuart.
Now, Bob, what we'll be discussing is a very interesting topic. Many people always ask me in regards to, you know, Stuart, do you plan to run again in 2016? I said, no, I have no intentions of running as a candidate in 2016. So anyway, I'll get that part of the business out of the way. And also, when we look at 2012, we had many candidates: Jerry White, we had James Harris, we had Peter Lindsay, we had other people that were running as candidates for seeking the nomination of various socialist organizations. But what we're going to be discussing today, Bob, is will socialists be ready? And when I say ready, for election 2016, will socialists be ready? Now, Bob, there are many socialist organizations, as I mentioned, that are out there in the country. And some of them are on a local level, and, of course, many of them are on a national level as well. But, Bob, in your opinion, are there any socialist organizations prepared to run a national campaign that would have a viable presidential candidate in 2016?
Well, turn the question around a little bit. And instead of saying a socialist ready, I think we have to ask, are the working people in the country ready for a socialist candidate? And
way to rephrase it.
Yeah, and that answer is no. They just are not. I don't know why. They should be. I mean, they've been kicked around often enough. Their standard of living has gone way down. Nothing looks rosy. Their kids are in debt. Their kids' lives are basically ruined if this stuff continues. And they're doing nothing. They have not turned, never mind revolutionary, they haven't even turned to the left. There are too many that are turning to the right.
And one of the things I found very interesting, Bob, in 2012, when I was running as a presidential candidate with Alex Mendoza, I found a lot of people that were in socialist organizations before the election took place. Their votes were already swaying toward the capitalist candidate. They were saying that I think we need to put our support behind Obama. I was really surprised and shocked at that. What did you see?
Yeah, I saw the same thing. And you know, I mean, I could almost excuse it in 2008 because it was a viable candidate, person of color. And I remember my partner, for example, she was very excited about Obama. She was very excited about Obama. She teaches college and proved after his election that she teaches a lot of minority kids. And they were just overjoyed. They were just gleeful over the whole thing. I mean, it really helped them. They really took it personally that they now had a chance to make it. So I kind of can excuse it in 2008 a little bit, but in 2012,
right,
I don't know what happened.
Right, because they had already seen the damage.
Yeah, right. Yep.
They had already
seen
the broken promises.
Yep. And you know, Romney, I mean, yeah, Romney's scary like anybody else in the right, but he's no scarier than John McCain was. He's no scarier than Bob Dole or Ronald Reagan or any of these others. So I don't know what drove the far left, the progressive left, into Obama's hands. You're right. It did happen, and our efforts to stop that were completely ignored, pretty much. I mean,
right. And what I could see also, Bob, some of the persons that were voters and they were supporting socialist organizations, they didn't support the socialist candidates because they were saying, well, Obama, he has done certain things. He has created jobs, which we could see that they were not real good-paying jobs. And actually, when Obama came into office, there were more people added to the unemployment lines under Obama than what it was when George Bush went out of office. And then I saw other people were saying that, Obama, you know, he just needs another 4 years because he's still cleaning up the damage behind Bush. And then I even saw those who were saying, well, he came out with Obamacare, and that's going to help to provide health care for all. And that was just a lack of understanding of the damage that Obamacare was going to create. But I didn't really see where, you know, in 2012 was a very disappointing year for the socialist organizations and also for the candidates. So going into 2016, it seemed like they're already going in from a weak position.
Yeah, and you know, if we step back and we don't make it personal against Obama, we just basically step back and see what is happening here. Why aren't people like the socialist idea? They like our issues. When we get out there and we explain that we want, you know, free health care for everybody, we want, you know, free college education, we want homes for everybody, we want jobs for everybody who wants to work. We explain these things, people are behind us. So why don't we get the votes? Why don't people look to us? And never mind Obama, it's the Democrat Party. It is them. It is because they take the steam, the anger, and they dissipate it by giving us somebody like a Clinton or an Obama or, you know, any of the other candidates they put up there. They dissipate the action, and they prevent people from actually getting out there and making positive change for themselves. The party's been bought off, and this is their role.
Bob, and this is only in your opinion because, you know, obviously we're not looking at this from a scientific approach. How well do you think the socialist presidential candidates, how well did they do in 2012? Obviously, as I mentioned, we had Jerry White, we had James Harris, we had myself running as a candidate, Peyton Lindsay, we had even Roseanne Barr running on the National Campaign for the Peace and Freedom Party. But in your opinion, how did the socialist candidates fare in 2012?
I don't want to put down anybody who tried. So that would exclude Roseanne.
That's good. Okay, that was good.
Did I insult somebody?
Bob is a lot of work. You start realizing how much work there is and how much money you need when you run a presidential campaign. It's a lot of work. I found myself running as a candidate. I was putting in 40 to 50 hours a week working on that campaign. It was a lot of work. So that's a good, you know, good approach. You say you don't want to put anyone down, but did the socialist candidates, was it just to keep our names and our ideas for the parties that we even have that snowball's chance in 2012?
You know, we don't have the depth. Like when you look at you know, back when Debs was getting a lot of votes back in the early 1900s, you look at, you know, when the other socialist candidates for president were at least taken a little, you know, more seriously. We had city councilmen, we had the majority of city councils, we had mayors, we had socialist mayors out there. We had, you know, socialist and communist. Outright communist mayors out there, and you know, so there was a depth. There was a party machinery. There were people who were, you know, getting the votes out for us and things like that. We don't have that. We don't have that anymore. So I didn't hear you.
Yeah, no. So you're saying that we're lacking any type of structure to be able to make all this workforce today. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I mean, the presidential, running for president, none of you people who ran for president actually thought you were going to win. I mean, you know, you run to win, but you don't actually think you're going to win. You don't take a defeatist attitude about it, but you're running for different reasons. You're running to get the word out there so in 4 or 8 or 12 years we have a chance. That's really what you're running for, right? I mean, and for that, I mean, you know, you can't put somebody down for trying their hardest to do that, because it's exactly what you should be doing at this kind of a point.
Well,
but, you know, again, the working people in this country
are ready. What should the candidates, what should they have done differently from what they did? I mean, when I think, you know, looking back on the campaign when I ran as a vice presidential candidate with Brian Moore in 2008, when I ran as a presidential candidate in 2012, part of what I could see is the apparatus of the party. The, you know, being prepared as far as having the apparatus in the party where we were working together in unity, because I could see that myself personally, much of the support of the party was not there. And when I say the support, I'm talking about the membership within the party. There wasn't a lot of members. It was nationwide. It's a little over 1,600 members. But when it came to the support on a national level, I probably had less than 20% of those that really rallied around the campaign. So that was part of what was lacking. The other thing is fundraising. When you start realizing what is necessary even to raise just small amounts, again, it's getting to that membership and letting them know that we need to do this as an organization for fundraising, and that wasn't in place. So what I'm thinking from the position of the party that I was representing was to make certain that we had the apparatus together within the party where it was a clear voice, not only from the candidate, but the leadership in the party saying, we need to be in this together. With the membership, and that wasn't there. But what did you see? Because you were there with the Peace and Freedom Party. You saw the socialist candidates here in California. What do you see that they could have done differently?
Well, I'm not active with the party, and I wasn't active with the party at the time. I'm still a member, and, you know, it is a only socialist party that really I have an option for here in California, so I do support and vote for the party.
What about in 2008? Were you active with the party then?
No, I was active in between.
Okay.
So, but, no, I didn't have anything to do with Nader or Roseanne Barr. You know, I understand what's happening with the Peace and Freedom Party. As far as I understand it, is they've been served notice, new regulations, new law coming in, that if they don't almost double their membership by 2014, they're going to be knocked off the ballot.
That's true.
Okay, now this is really a sad thing, because they do have, I think, 50 or 60,000 members last I checked, probably more than that now, because they have been trying to get more members. But this is really the
60,000 registered voters.
Right, registered voters. And that's pretty good for a socialist party. I mean, even in California, that's pretty good.
They have approximately close to 300 members. That's members, people that actually dues paying members to the party.
Right, okay. And, you know, given that they are trying to keep their ballot status, they have a tendency, I believe, to try to nominate people who will help that. And the celebrity seems to be the way to do it for them.
Right.
You know, and hindsight, you know, I can be critical of that, but at the time I can't be. I mean, you can't, you know, they're a party that's going down, and they're panicking, or maybe they're, you know, just trying whatever they can, or maybe they're just taking their best shot. So, you know, for example, either Nader or Barr, whether that was a good idea or not in hindsight, at the time, it was probably the best option they had.
Right. Well, Bob, when you consider the cost for the two corporate parties to run presidential campaigns these days, that cost now is exceeding $1 billion between Obama and Mitt Romney. both camps spent well over $1.5 billion in this past election. How can a socialist candidate compete on such a field?
Through organization, through the grassroots, you know. I mean, if we can't do it ourselves, then through the unions. But the unions are still married to the Democratic Party, so we don't have that option. I have a question. I mean, when you were campaigning 50 or 60 hours a week, were you still working?
I was working full time.
Yeah. See, I mean, you know, that's our candidate.
I was putting in 40 plus hours a week. I don't even know how I had so much Stuart Alexander to spread around.
I mean, you should have gotten a lot of press coverage just for that, Stuart.
Well, I got a lot of press coverage, fortunately. And fortunately, I didn't have to pay for it. But for that, I should have gotten press coverage just for that.
Mm-hmm. Because no other candidate has to do that.
I was traveling around the country.
Right.
For me?
No other candidate has to do that. You know, work
right.
And campaign. I mean, you know, the campaign ends up being a 4-year-long full-time job for them.
Right. It was a full-time job for me, Bob. I mean, I would wake up at 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I would be working on the campaign. I would go to work, and when I get back from work, I would be eating at my computer, or I would be eating on the road, going somewhere to speak. And then I'll be working until 11 or 12 o'clock at night. Sometimes
wow.
I'm trying to catch up notes when I was on a plane. I mean, but it was full time. And within the last 2 years, I don't think I took any more than like maybe around 4 or 5 days off for that whole year. I mean, it was grueling.
Stuart, you just talked me out of ever running for president.
Okay. Bob, many of the socialist organizations, let's face it, they're poorly organized, and some are very well organized. And of course, we can see when I look at the party, the Freedom Socialist Party, they're very organized state by state, and they do things very well. When I look at PSL, Party for Socialism and Liberation, they are very organized throughout the country. Do you see any socialist organizations being prepared enough to compete with the Democrats and Republicans coming this 2006 election?
No, I mean, I don't think we can expect them to be, and I don't think that should
right.
be their focus. I mean,
right.
you know, the events are getting out of hand now. We don't know what's going to happen. I don't see anything good happening with the economy. Being there is probably the most important thing at this point. You know, I mean, we're all in your situation that you were at. We all have to work. We all have to have an income. We all have to take care of our families. We don't have
right.
maids. We don't have butlers. We don't have, you know, a driver. We don't have, you know, a pack that's going to pay us, you know, what we need to live on and you know, retirement and health care and all that. So the most we can do is pretty much what we're doing. I don't think we can expect more of these individuals who are working for socialism.
Now, Bob, I don't know if you feel comfortable answering this question here. If you don't, then we can just move on. But the Party for Socialism and Liberation, they nominated a 29-year-old as their national presidential candidate. In your opinion, do you think that was a mistake?
Well, I guess the controversy you're pointing out is that she was underage and she could not underage, but she was too young to be able to serve. So she, even if she had won,
no, she was underage.
Right. She wasn't underage as in like under 18. She was like in her 20s, I think. And
yeah, and the Constitution say 35.
Right. So she could not have served if she had won. And that kind of relates to me to when Peace and Freedom Party, maybe, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, they nominated Leonard Peltier.
Peltier, mm-hmm.
Yeah, who is, you know, a Native American activist in jail on trumped-up murder charges. Yeah, he
mm-hmm.
couldn't have served either.
Right.
So sometimes I think that there's it's a good thing to try to make a point. And I think, well, let me tell you a little story. I brought my daughter to a socialist meeting once. She was 18 or 19, and there were a couple of PSL people there. And not knowing much about her or anything, they walked up to her and said, 18, 19-year-old girl, you should be running for office.
Whoa.
This is very empowering for her.
Well,
I mean, you know, say what you want about it.
Ignoring her father, I understand.
I think they would have done it to anybody who was 18 or 19. And I think what it points to, maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, PSL is welcome to correct me. I think it points to a long-term strategy of theirs is to promote young people into the electoral arena. And
right.
I don't see a big problem with that. I mean, I like the long-term thinking.
A friend of mine had told me that a person who isn't a socialist but is friendly said that to her that was just a mockery of the whole process on nominating somebody or running someone who was like 28 or 29. And she thought that that would do more damage to the whole idea than good. So I just wanted to throw that in.
And I've heard that from several people. And, of course, they're entitled to their opinions. And, of course, I was just asking, Bob, you know, I was just asking your opinion on that. But sometimes people look at that as they look at the party and the organization and they say, well, are they really serious? And I think we had to come across as being serious organizations because we're dealing with serious issues here, especially when we talk about the lives of working class people. But when you look at the Peace and Freedom Party, they nominated Roseanne Barr as their national presidential candidate. Again, in your opinion, Bob, was that a mistake?
I think in hindsight, it's very easy for us to say, and I would kind of bet that a lot of people who voted for her in the party would probably agree that it was a mistake because she did not seem to. You know, she's welcome to correct me, but she did not seem to be as viable a candidate as the PSL person did.
she wasn't.
We didn't
at
see
least
her.
The PSL person was a socialist, and she believed in socialism.
Right. But, you know, Roseanne Barr almost acted like this is just something to put on a resume, and, you know, I'll be back in 4 years. It wasn't that they elected her or the strategy of electing her was the issue. It was her. She let us down. That's what happened.
And she ran running as a candidate. She made certain promises just 3 weeks before the election. They didn't even before the nomination, rather. They had no clue that she even wanted to seek their nomination. She had been turned down by the Green Party, which is the capitalist party. And then she came over to the Peace and Freedom Party in the 11th hour and said, well, I'll be your candidate, and if you nominate me as your candidate, I'll make certain that I fund your registration drive and make certain you stay on the ballot. And I think since then she's probably gone back to Hawaii, and she's retired on her macadamia farm, I believe. Yeah. But to me, that wasn't, that wasn't fulfilling the promises that socialists are expecting to be fulfilled from a socialist organization. They're looking for leadership, people that will get in the trenches and deal with the issues that are important to working people. And if we're talking about 2016, Bob, we can't be making those kind of mistakes because, as I mentioned, socialists and working people – We're living in some pretty dire times, but and I'm not trying to beat up the parties because I respect what these parties have done. But we have to stop taking one step forward and three steps backwards. We need to stop doing that again. And a lot of these things, these are only in your opinion. Bob, Roseanne Barr, do you think that she was prepared to lead the U.S. down a road of for revolutionary change? Say, for instance, where people just listening to her as a candidate, do you think she had the message that we needed as working people, where people can understand that this person is leading us down that road? I think you've already answered that question, though, but I'll still throw it out there at you.
Well, what I did like about her running was the narrative that, she was a celebrity, she was this, she was that, and then we had this big crisis and everything's getting bad, and so she investigated and explored and decided that she was a socialist. We want a lot of people to do that, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's what we want. And that was a good narrative. it wasn't true. I don't think it was true. I don't think she actually, you know, she's still out there, you know, talking that she's a socialist and that she's going to run for president again. And but I just don't see it. I just don't see. I don't see her as being honest about it. I kind of think she's just doing. She's just doing it to pad a resume. It's good.
Recently, Bob, and I might mention very briefly, we have Bob Maskey. He's joining our program once again. Bob came on. Actually, he's been on the program several times. He always has a lot to add to the program, speaking about socialist issues, issues that are relevant to working people. And today, Bob is joining us. We're discussing about election 2016. Will socialists be ready? And what we're saying, will they be ready? Socialist candidates, will people as socialists, will they be ready to go and vote for socialist candidates? So we want to just discuss that issue, will they be ready in 2016? And thanks again, Bob, for joining the program. Bob, recently we spoke to, and this program is sponsored by Ruth Ann, and she joins us from time to time, even joining in the program. But recently we spoke with a young socialist who is a leader in the National Socialist Organization. And we questioned her as to, you know, for a national organization, who was a spokesperson or who represented and spoke for the people within that organization. And that was saying who spoke for the organization when it came to the press, who spoke for the organization publicly, who represented that party. And basically, she came across saying, I'm not aware of who really represents the party, you know. But here this person is the national chair of the party. Bob, just in your opinion, and like I say, this is when we're talking about will socialists be prepared in 2016? We're looking at the leadership of a national party, a national socialist organization. Is there a problem there when we look at the leadership of organizations when they're not even aware of who's supposed to be representing their organization when we're talking to the people right at the top?
I can sense your frustration. But you know,
I think of Debbie Wasserman, you know, of Florida, and we're, you know, Rens Priebus with the Republican Party, at Debbie with
right.
Debbie Wasserman with the Democratic Party. I don't think Debbie would have an issue like who represents the party, who represents the Democrats. If I spoke to President Obama, do you speak for your party? I don't think he would have a question about that. But we're talking about who represents your organization on the national level, and we're speaking with the national chair.
Yeah. I think
it
might all come down to, you know, we're not professional politicians. We're just not. We're not organized that way. Even when I've been involved in the ballot party, I mean, it sometimes there were just big gaping holes that weren't addressing, and it all comes down to, I think it all comes down to the fact that we all have to work, we all have to, you know, feed our families, we've got kids who have problems, we have, you know, we're taking care of our elderly parents, we're trying to get the car fixed, we have all these issues that we have to take care of as individuals, and we're not schooled, we're not slick, we're not professional as far as the professional politician goes, and sometimes I don't know if we want to lose all that. You know, I mean, you know, do we really want to just become another Democratic Party?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I think any organization needs to have leadership, and leadership boils down to who represents your party, who speaks for the party. Obviously, if there's 300 million people in this country, you can't have 300 million voices. You need to have one voice that speaks for 300 million, not 300 million speaking for 300 million. Otherwise, it's nothing but confusion.
Yeah, well, look at Occupy. I mean, Occupy has done it without a national spokesman. So, I mean, can it be done?
Well,
I think you lose something.
Who speaks for Occupy?
Anybody in Occupy.
Okay. Anyway. Okay, so we're going to have a lot of candidates in 2016. Okay. Hey, Bob, I'm really enjoying this more than I should. Hey, Ruthann, were you going to ask something?
Say what?
Were you going to ask something, Ruthann?
No, I was just saying that you don't have to be slick to be organized, but you're not going to gain at least members like me and other people who like a little organization when there is
right.
none. There must be some type of organization. That's all.
Right. I'm going to vote for the candidate that has the best organization behind him. If I see behind that candidate there's nothing but pure chaos, he's probably going to lose my vote, you know.
Yeah.
But... And another thing, Bob, I've contacted several organizations requesting, and I should say socialist organizations, requesting the availability of someone to come on this program, the Socialist Insight, and, you know, just to share what their organizations are doing nationally. However, in most cases, now this is in most cases, Bob, my requests have been just turned down. Time and time again has been turned down. Now, I shouldn't say every time because, as I mentioned, I had a young lady come on a few weeks ago, and she said, you know, I will come and speak for organization. She wasn't certain who was supposed to come on and be a spokesperson. I said, well, you're the national chair. That's good enough for me. If I asked Kevin Akin with the Peace and Freedom Party, he would be more than willing to come on and speak to represent the Peace and Freedom Party here in California.
Uh-huh.
But Bob, if we believe working people need to understand what socialism has to offer, should we be seeking a broader audience?
You know, I've identified myself as a socialist since I was late teenage years, over 40 years, and that issue has not changed. That, you know, it almost seems like, you know, you join a group and then that group turns inwards.
Right.
Is that kind of what you're getting at? I mean, you know, and then...
Well, what I'm saying is people that are representing, speaking for their organizations, I mean, other than just turning inward and speaking just to the membership within our organization, should those people be willing to come on programs like this on television? These people are being invited... Outside of an election year, they're being invited on radio. They're being invited on national TV. They're being invited for a press conference, and they're just turning them down. No, we're not available. Not available. Election time come around, they're trying to get in front of the cameras, and the cameras are turning away from them. No, we don't want to listen to you because we're listening to Obama now. Here's a press conference. We need to cut you off at this time. But right now is a good opportunity to be able to talk to the working people so they can understand what is being offered, and they're not seeking that broader audience. They have, like, you know, time out. You know, there's no time for business right now. But
I think you might have two issues here. I think the first issue is you know, the national spokesperson getting out there in front of the media and everything. And the other issue is where socialist groups don't want to speak to each other. And you're kind of identified as a part of one or two socialist groups.
And that's a good question you just brought up right there, Bob. Socialist organizations not willing to speak to each other.
Right, and I found that, and I've been very, very frustrated by that. I mean, I don't agree with all socialists. We do have some big differences, but they're still my comrades. And while I don't agree with them, you know, while I don't agree with them, we should be talking. And sometimes the talking is not going to be real, maybe not polite, and maybe not, you know, maybe even uncomfortable. But we should be. We all represent working people. And we all have the same fears about the same enemies.
You know, even though I may be critical in certain areas, they're still my comrades, and I always want to be there for them. Sometimes they don't want me to be there for them as well, but I still want to be there when they need me or if I can be able to offer any type of assistance. Now, Bob, in the last few minutes, well, we have around another 20-something minutes, and we're just going to get into a different area of discussion here. And what I would like to do is discuss some of the issues that socialist presidential candidates will need to address in the next 3 years. And we need to start talking about these issues. We can't start talking about those issues in 2015. But what I like to do is focus on some of the issues that we're going to need to be addressing as the election and campaign, the campaign for 2016. Do I think a candidate is going to win in 2016, a socialist candidate? No. But we can still talk and address those issues and let working people know that capitalism is not working. Now,
right.
One of the things at the top of my agenda, Bob, is human and civil rights. We have taken some serious setbacks with Obama. All these people that went and voted for him and thought he needed another 4 years, well, he has another 4 years to create even more damage. But how should socialists address the human and civil rights issues coming into 2016? And these are issues, Bob, that they need to start talking about today, talking about May 27th, 2013, and moving forward.
Yeah.
And
yep.
When I'm talking about these issues, one of the things is the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. This is a lot of damage and is creating devastation, and it's an insult to the rights of working people. But what about starting with that, the human and civil rights? And we'll start with the National Defense Authorization Act.
You know, I hate to be Chicken Little, you know, and I mean, I think this is sometimes a problem of the progressive left, is that we do yell and scream sometimes and say, gee, you know, this horrible thing has happened. But sometimes I wonder how close we are to actual fascism here. You know, it seems like we are. I know we're drifting into it. I mean, it's hard to gauge. I almost feel like, you know, I almost feel like a 1930 German wondering, you know, gee, you know, union guy up in Germany, you know, where exactly is it when my life is going to be threatened here? You know, I mean,
right,
everything
exactly.
else is under attack. So yeah, I'm really concerned about things like NDAA. The problem is again, the Democrats are the ones pushing this stuff now. If it's the Democrats pushing it, what do you do when it's a two-party system and you have one crazy wacko party and you have one conservative corporate party?
Yeah, good point. I mean, here the Democrats are pushing all of this nonsense.
Yep.
So this is where a good starting point where we need to be saying that here is the party that's supposed to be representing working people on a national level. And here they're pushing the same agenda that the Republicans are pushing.
Right.
Now,
and it's not just the NDAA. It's the attacks on the internet. It's Bradley Manning in jail without trial. It's the only person who's gotten the national attention on any of this stuff was Libertarian Rand Paul, who, you know, I do not support, but he was at least talking about drone strikes and murders of Americans. And it's sad that a far right winger like him is the one who's speaking up against all this stuff and gets the national press. And it's because then all of a sudden he can change his mind and he's gone from the and that makes the issue disappear. We're still saying the same things. We're still saying we shouldn't be murdering Americans without a trial. We're still saying we shouldn't be reading everybody's email. We're still saying all those things. You know, we're the ones who are being consistent here.
And when we talk about human rights, I mean, when we talk about what is happening at Guantanamo, when we talk about what is happening with the drones, when we're talking about the way that we are going into attacking various nations and what and the havoc that we are creating on sovereign societies, this, I mean, Bob, the list goes on and on.
Yep.
And
yep.
Then also we can talk about the civil rights, what is happening in the streets with police here
yep.
in this country. I mean, they're preparing for warfare against working people. I mean, so, I mean, these are things that we need to be addressing and talking about starting from May 27th going forward.
But you know,
these are issues.
Here's the problem. Here's the way I see the problem, right, is that why is Obama doing all this? He's behaving as a right-wing conservative, and he should understand by now the right-wing conservatives don't like him and never will, if for no other reason than his skin color. They do not like him. They, you know, he could you know, turn into Ronald Reagan, and they still wouldn't like him. I don't know. What is the point of the Democrats and Obama doing all these things? The only I don't really have an answer. That's kind of rhetorical, but you know, it just points to the question. You know, how deep into fascism are we already, and how much deeper are we going to go?
And the thing is, Obama, I think he's gone probably further than what Mitt Romney could have ever even dreamed of going. He's definitely gone further than what Bush has gone. But, you know, I have a few areas that we need to cover, and I probably won't be able to cover them all today. Healthcare, big one. You know, this is something we know that we were talking about, single payer that was needed for working class people. We got a substandard program with Obamacare. Working people are still thinking that this is going to be the cure for providing healthcare, the healthcare needs of working people. But even the courts are saying that it's a tax. We can see that employers are realizing that it's going to be costly to them. But what's very important is it will be extremely costly to working people. What should we be saying about health care going to 2016? What I'm saying is we should still be stressing single payer. Could you explain what single payer health care, what that is all about, Bob?
Be sure. Well, we've talked about Obamacare for a few times now, and just going back a little bit, I wanted to add that the public option was a really good idea.
Right.
When they took the public option out of it, because to be honest with you, I don't think the for-profit insurance companies could have in any way actually competed against a public option, and I think they would have all gone broke, and that's why it wasn't even offered as a part of the bill. But if it had been offered as it, I might have actually been able to shut up for a little while about Obamacare. But they took that right off the table very early.
Bob, if they had left the public option on the table, myself as a socialist would have supported it.
Right.
You know,
so
I think it would have been an interim, something that would have helped in the meantime. I don't think it would have been the long-term solution, but I would have supported that on the short term. As soon as they took the public option off the table, I was done with it.
Yep. And I think most Democrats were, too. I think most Democrats were furious about it, too. But it seems like, you know, again, this 1930 Germany attitude, everybody has a real short memory. Sometimes they, you know.
Right. No, you're right.
Yeah. So, you know, the single payer is basically the same as Medicare, right? I mean, you know, basically you go to the doctor and the government gets the bill, and sometimes you get a little bit of a charge. Sometimes you get a percentage charge. But there is another option too. There's another option, and this one I kind of like a little better. And it's like our Veterans Administration is run, our veterans hospitals, and that's actually run by the government. It's owned by the government. The doctors and nurses are government employees. Same system as they have in England.
It's a form of socialism.
Right. Well, it's definitely socialism, and you know that's also kind of a single payer program, but I kind of like that idea too. And you know we could easily have a few hour conversation on the healthcare system.
Oh,
but,
we could.
You know, and it's a mess, and it's going to continue being a mess. And what should have happened here? Let me get a quick comment in here. If a socialist were in charge, or if sane socialists were in charge here, what we would have done 10 years ago is encouraged young people to go into the medical profession. We would have paid their entire college tuition to become doctors and nurses and pharmacists and everything else we needed, knowing that our population is aging. We would have planned ahead. We would have known what was going to happen. It's kind of late now to do that. Everybody's trying to scramble now. Everybody's talking about, you know, opening up the nurses' colleges and everything, and making, you know, allowing nurses to do this and that, and opening up clinics. But it's kind of late because we're already aging. We're already in that point where we need all this extra health care. So the health care system, just because of the aging population, was due to a collapse. If something didn't happen, and capitalism cannot, capitalism is short term. It thinks a few years ahead at most. It does not prepare for a generation ahead. It does not prepare for 10 or 15 years ahead, as socialism would.
Right. And you're correct about that, because capitalism has built in the system. It's already built in that there's going to be something that's going to happen, some type of catastrophic change every 150 years. But now, within the last 150 years, it started going to 75 years. And now we're down to like a 7 to 15-year window. So, I mean, let's face it, the next one is already planned. It's already planned for the next 2 to 3 years from now. When it comes to unemployment and wages, now that's a big one that any socialist candidate, not that they'll win in 2016, but this is, you know, socialist candidates need to be discussing about high unemployment. Bob, let's face it, today we have well over 20 million people in this country that are unemployed. Not to mention that the household incomes are dropping while the cost of living is going up. Socialists need to be talking about unemployment and wages, talking about $10 an hour, talking about $15 an hour. Even a recent survey came out saying if it kept up with the cost of living over the past half century, wages should be over $21 an hour. But this is something, Bob, that we need to be talking about.
You know, and it's part of the same story as the social safety net. It's not just that we're unemployed. It's not just that our wages are shrinking. It's not just that we all have to work a lot harder and the whole family's got to work now. It's that when we're unemployed, our unemployment insurance isn't good enough. Our medical coverage is gone or non-existent. All these other things that like the European countries have, you know, a strong social safety net so that when things do go bad, when the economy does go bust, as always happens with capitalism, it's called a business cycle, that the people don't lose everything every 7 years.
Right.
But that's what we're going for now, is everybody's going to lose everything every 7 years. You're going to build, you know, work hard, build it all back up, and then the banks are going to steal it all again.
Right. And Bob, when we talk about these issues, I mean, a lot of it comes to the growing poverty rate that we have here in this country. When we look at the growing poverty in this country, in the U.S. and the world, let's face it, it's definitely on the rise. They have one out of every six people in Los Angeles is living on some type of public assistance.
Oh.
One out of six.
Yeah.
That's poverty. And when we look at the world, we look at the world. Capitalism is taking working people into a state of poverty worldwide. Now, when we talk, how should working people address the poverty in the U.S. and also the world coming into 2016? My thing is, Bob, we need to change the way that we are doing business, and we need to change the way we're doing business on a national level and also on a international level. Let's face it, we have, you've heard that term that the big corporations, that they have too big to fail, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you know, let me tell you something. Working people are too big to fail, too. We're a big group of people worldwide, and we should not be in a position where we're going to fail. I think we need to have, as they have with the Peace and Freedom Party, you know, my roots in socialism came up with that party. What do you think about a guaranteed basic income, guaranteed, which they have there in the platform of the Socialist Party USA, that they have also with the Freedom Socialist Party, with the Peace and Freedom Party? What is your idea that if big corporations and the government want to make certain that big corporations will not fail and they will make certain that they have the income to survive, shouldn't working people also have income, necessary income, where it will take care of their basic needs.
Wow, that's just crazy talk, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy talk, but let's talk about it.
Makes so much sense, doesn't
let's
it?
Let's talk about it. I mean, but, you know, let me tell you something else that's very interesting, Bob. If you look at, and obviously we know Richard Nixon wasn't a socialist, you know.
Yep.
But if we go back to 1969, would you believe that Richard Nixon introduced an idea of a basic income in Congress, wow, and it passed the House?
Wow.
And
wow,
would you believe that it was also introduced in 1935 by the Roosevelt administration, and nothing ever happened with it? But wow, what do you think about a basic income to make certain that the basic needs of working people are taken care of?
Yeah. Well, I wonder if the John Birch Society was right about Nixon being a communist, you know? Maybe.
Well, he wasn't a socialist. I don't know about a communist, but he definitely wasn't a socialist.
Do you know who else proposed the minimum, the guaranteed minimum income? Was Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King, I
believe.
Good point.
He certainly did.
And Martin Luther King, we know he was a supporter of socialism.
Yep. Even though they're trying to change that. They're trying to change that perception of Martin Luther King. You know, now he's a right winger.
And I hope they don't. You know, and that's our job, to make certain that they don't do that.
Well, before we know it, they'll be trying to change Debs, too, you know, to being a right-wing Nazi or something, right? But,
they're going to try to change Stuart Alexander and Bob.
You know, the thing I was talking about before with let's not mix – let's include in this guaranteed minimum income things like the Social Security or the social safety net.
No, we include that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a part of it. That, we don't have to be talking about, you know, cutting everybody a check every week. What we're talking about is if somebody loses their job or they're disabled or they can't go to work, they don't have to worry that they're going to get thrown out of their house, that they're going to get sick, that they're going to have to be on the street, that they're going to have to live under a bridge anymore. You know, we're talking about people being able to live with dignity. Whether we give them cash or whether we give them – or whether they're provided with the basic necessities that they need.
Right, exactly. And what we're talking about is making certain that they have – where they have an income to take care of the basic necessities. We're not talking about making people rich. But make certain food, clothing, and housing, the basic needs are met. And that's not meaning that, you know, people are going to be not having to go to work, because, you know, you know people say, well, socialists believe in welfare and that no one has to work and everyone's going to take care of them. That's not what we're talking about. But we don't need to have poverty where people are sleeping in cardboard boxes, living in their cars, you know, trying to sleep in parks on benches with blankets or whatever. That's not necessary. But that's what happens in a capitalist society. That's what capitalism brings into society for working people.
And when you talk about people who don't want to work and don't work, we're talking about the wealthy. We're not talking about working people.
Oh, yeah.
We're not talking
about
the unemployed. You want to talk about somebody who's lazy and leeching off of the system, it's the wealthy who are doing that.
Exactly. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to cover just a couple more items. Actually, I'm going to cover one more because we have around three more minutes. I want you to give you contact information. One of the big ones that we have is immigration. How should, approaching 2016, starting with May 27, 2013, how should we address this issue? Because the Democrats and the Republicans, they always use immigration as a football. And tell you the truth, I'm getting tired of it. When it comes to election time, when it comes to getting votes, all of a sudden, you know, they have the immigration issue on the table, and it becomes a political football. But how should socialists address that very hot topic?
I think the safest way of doing it and the most just way of doing it is to follow the lead of the immigrants' rights group locally. I mean, you know, here in California, we have a large population of immigrants. Their organizations are everywhere. They're fighting. I almost, you know, and it's parallel to our socialist fight, but it's different too. And so we have to be supportive. We have to be supportive. We have to be there as a part of what they're doing. I don't think we should necessarily take the lead on it, in other words. I think we have to, sometimes
that's
we have
fair.
To be followers.
Great. And we have student debt right now is over $1.2 trillion. It's actually $1.116 trillion in this country. And that's debt. The students are just being, it's like a ball and chain around their neck. I think that this that type of debt to students should be forgiven. What is your opinion on that?
Oh, absolutely.
Is this something that should be a main focus for candidates speaking up on that hot issue coming into approaching 2016?
Yeah, and not even just forgiven. I mean, it should never have happened in the first place. Nobody should have lost sleep over getting a better education. You know, college.
Right.
You know, education through college should be free. But if you look at what they're trying to do, they're trying to privatize the schools so that we're going to even have to pay for, you know, K-1 through 12. I mean,
right.
You know, they're going in the exact opposite direction of what the American people want them to do, about what's just, what's fair, what's right, what's even economically right, because there's a few extra pennies for some people going in the opposite direction.
Right. Well, Bob, I really appreciate you joining the program once again. Bob, I want you to give you contact information. Bob, you got to promise that you're going to join the program again.
Hey, this was fun.
You know, I always have fun every time you come on the program. It's like a one-hour conversation, and this is the only way I can ever catch up with you. Bob, give me your contact information. We're going to look forward to having you on in the next 3 to 4 weeks, okay? Could you give our listeners your contact information?
Sure. People could find me on Facebook at Bob, B-O-B. Maskey, M-A-S-C-H-I.
And, folks, I want you to remember Bob's name and also his contact information. He's looking at eventually having his own program, and once he gets his program on Blog Talk, I'm looking forward to being on there very frequently. But anyway, Bob Maskey, he's joining our program once again. I look forward to having him to join us. Also, thanks again, Bob. You can
thanks
reach myself. My contact information is StuartAlexanderCares.com. That's StuartAlexanderCares.com. Just go to the webpage and post any information that you would like to have in our comments section, either for myself or our guests. And also, you can also always join in the program just by dialing in, and we look forward to your comments. Once again, thanks for joining the Socialist Insight. Thank you, Ruth Ann. We look forward to having you to join us once again with Alan Mackey. Thanks again. Have a good night.
Thanks,
see you
guys.
Later.
You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
You're on the air. Blog Talk is having some issues. We can't do much with the music today. It must just be, I don't know, that the people are gone for the weekend, too. They've told us they'll be back tomorrow. So do you want to just go ahead and start?
Sure, that sounds great.
I'm sure Ron will be calling in shortly.
I think he said he was already on the line. I just called him briefly, and he said that he was waiting in the queue. Ron, are you there?
No, he's not. He's not on the board, or I'd have him on.
Oh dear. Okay. I don't know if we should start without him because he's the guest. So what should I do?
Well, I can play some more music, and you can call him and tell him to try. Make sure he's got the right number.
Yeah, he does have the right number, and he said he was waiting in the queue. But he's also been on the George Norrie show and had some technical difficulties, too, because his story is profound, and I'm sure that they don't want him on, you know, rattling off all this stuff. So that's probably why they're keeping him off. Uh-huh. So
well, that's
let
George
me
show, but this is Blog Talk, and, yeah, they have enough issues without worrying about who's on. So, yeah, see, we'll just play. Let's see. Well, we'll play some music here.
Okay, I'll give him one more call and just see because he said he was waiting in the queue, but I'll try. Okay?
Well, that he's not showing on the board. So.
Okay, I'll have him call right back in.
Okay, this is Golden Hour by Drazy Hope.
Of time is flicking dimly up on the screen. I can't see the line I used to think I could read between. Perhaps my brain will turn to sand. Oh me, oh my, I think it's been an eternity. You'd be surprised at my degree of uncertainty. Thank you.
Okay, everybody's here.
You're great.
Here.
Welcome to the Research Rabbit Hole Radio Show with Cynthia Hamill. Happy Memorial Day to you and your family. Tonight, we have a special guest on the show, Ron Gilman, who is a targeted individual from Seattle and has some great stories to tell on electronic harassment and the uses of directed energy weapon attacks using chemtrail and satellite technologies. Welcome to the show, Ron.
Well, thank you very much, Cynthia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's so great to have you on the show, and you were one of the very special guests that I just saw at the conference, the Super Soldier Conference in Henderson, Nevada, right outside of Vegas this past week, and I was so impressed with your performance. I was like, man, I've got to get him on my radio show, because the thing that I admired most about your presentation was you were sharing information that a lot of people would typically not even share with their best friend, but you were sharing it in a way where you were impacting everyone in the audience, and I really admired that, and your delivery was absolutely impeccable. So I'm so glad that you're on my show.
Sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction, and I believe that's the way to get in touch with everybody. A little spice of reality, you know, brings your attention right quite close. So.
Very true. Now, you have a whole list of things that I didn't rattle off yet, all these different things that you've done. One of the things that I was real impressed with was the fact that you started a group in Seattle about a year ago for other targeted individuals, and that you actually won a court case proving electronic surveillance police harassment. So that was really an outstanding thing to hear. So can you talk a little bit about that, Ron?
Yes, I'd love to. My group in Seattle is a branch of the Freedom from Covert Harassment and Surveillance, which I was fortunate enough to find probably 4 months into my targeting. And I knew there was other people like me, because I had this feeling that we're all over the place and I had to find them. So when I formed my group, there was only two other groups in the country, from what I understand. And in forming the group, it didn't take long, and we got up to upwards of about 20 people right away. And we shared stories and information and such. And it's good to talk to other targeted individuals. It's good for the mind and soul, as they try to take both of them. So that's what my belief was, and it was very productive. Since the group has formed, the only problem is a lot of people in the group don't understand that they can change your mind in midstream, and a lot of the people haven't came back to the group. To explain that would take a while, but there's subliminal messages or silent thoughts, and they could have made the group think that I was, you know, a perp, which is one of the people that do this atrocity to people, or, you know, it was a waste of time, et cetera. So I am still trying to get these people back together and convince them it's okay. One thing that does happen with me is my torture increased tenfold since
after
forming the group.
After you started this group, Ron, you mean?
I'm sorry?
You mean the torture increased tenfold after you started this group?
Oh, definitely. You bet.
I hear you. Yeah.
And I knew that was going to happen as part of the process, and it didn't, you know, I didn't, it didn't bother me. I knew I had to do what I had to do. So we're going to form the group back together here soon, and hopefully it stays together. It's hard to keep a group of people that get mind control together.
Right, I can just imagine. Yeah. Well, in your blurb earlier, you mentioned that you have endured heart palpitation attacks, the microwave within the brain technology, electroshocks to your body, and you even had one surgery to correct the microwave torture. So, can you talk a bit about that?
Well, the heart palpitations / heart attack. I've had ambulance come to my house and take me to the hospital for I thought I was having a heart attack. And from what I understand, it takes 3 seconds to eliminate anybody off the face of the earth with that weapon. And yes, they're very, very painful, very scary. I've been to the ER probably roughly in the last 3 years, maybe 24 times because of the microwave technology. The corrective surgery on the area where I was journaling for 10 months prior to the surgery was in between my big toe and my foot on the right foot. And for 2 years, I was telling doctors that the little diagram that you draw out where your pain is, it was all over my body, but every one of those included that area of my foot. And from what I understand, Barry Trower's with Barry Trower's videos, is they can actually calcify red blood cells with the microwave technology, which, in fact, make bone spurs. And the doctor who did the surgery was listening to what I was telling him, saying, hey, look, I get hit here all the time and something's going on. Well, finally, it showed up that calcification was happening. It ended up to be 4 bone spurs that were developed in a short period of time. And ever since the operation, they've picked on it even more. They keep hitting that same area. I don't know why it's the right foot, but if you hear other people's stories, a lot of it is the right foot, and it's in the toe areas. I've actually felt pain like my big toenail was being ripped off from the back forward.
Oh,
now,
man.
This weekend, I was fortunate enough to sit with Robert Duncan during lunch, and I had to quiz him. I had my one question, and my question was this: how in the heck can they make that sensation in someone's body unless they recorded that sensation out of someone's mind? And he said, bingo. He said, that is a recording of someone's actual torture.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there's things that I just, you have to sit back and wonder how they could do it. Well, the pain is so real and so intense, it can't be done without someone to experience it and being recorded. That's what I thought, and I was correct. So,
wow, yeah, you nailed it. I think I was there when you actually asked that question. So that's amazing.
Very fortunate to talk to that man. So
yes, definitely. Okay, now on your voice to skull, the V2K and Frey microwave hearing, you went into great depths of that in your speaking engagement when you were speaking on the stage, and I was real impressed with how you relayed that information. Can you kind of go into that? Because a lot of people don't understand that this is actually like a voice of God, which is basically narrating your life in different, you know, instances, something that comes in almost like a radio wave frequency where it literally sounds like someone's in your head. So can you kind of fill in the audience on that and give your perspective? Because what you shared in that audience was to the audience was phenomenal.
Well, I almost feel fortunate to have my voice to skull for the reason of this, is my friends and family get subliminal thought. And subliminal thought, or silent thought, or synthetic telepathy, is a thought projected inside the cerebral cortex of your mind, which is 80% of your thinking. And I get that probably roughly 100 times an hour, someone's throwing a thought in my head. But voice to skull backs up my subliminal with another suggestive thought after that, or a comment. Now, that's kind of strange to hear that. I feel fortunate to have voice to skull, but I couldn't imagine running around thinking, why am I thinking these thoughts only? And you know they're not your own thoughts. That's the whole thing. It's so far out of what you normally think, and they're just so abstract. They just go off in different directions all the time. And I believe the idea on the subliminals is just to wear the mind down. If you can imagine 100 different thoughts an hour coming into your head all day, every day, and trying to, you know, hold the conversation as I am on this phone right now, it's something you have to practice.
Yeah.
The V2K... V2K is very, very scary at the same time. I hear nothing but imminent demise. It's the dark black hole that everyone fears. The worst thing that you can possibly hear is harm to your children. When you hear, we know where your children are right now, you know, just, you know, jump off a cliff and they'll be okay. Well, really? I was fortunate enough to get this at 47, where in the any psychiatry book, you're not going to start hearing voices after the age of 40. And it usually happens between the early teenager and late or early 20s. So that's when paranoid schizophrenia, what have you, come in. But the voice of the skull, I hear four different voices. Now, in the beginning, a girl's voice captured me, and, you know, lo and behold, we're in love with each other, and it was very, very strange. And they get you to that point.
Yeah.
But pretty soon they become evil. And I hear three different men, very immature men, and
probably
one woman.
Probably on different shifts coming in,
well,
at different times.
What it is, it's not shifts. They use the same voices over. There has to be 20 individuals a day, because as much as they talk, that would wear the average person out in 20 minutes. So I believe they're in one-hour shifts.
Wow.
It's constant. It's all day. It's every day. There's not a moment in time that I don't hear them. If I
can
only plug them in
like
and let you hear what they're saying now. Pardon
me? Can you give us an example of, like, I think you gave an example on stage of, like, just changing a tire or doing some type of auto mechanic operation, you know, or something, and then hearing the voice as it was playing stuff out. Can you give us an example?
Oh, the one thing when I was working on the brakes at one time, you know, I'm constantly repairing my cars from the constant vandalism. They get you your emotional state, they control. I'm trying to fix a brake on my car, and they get you jacked up on, you know, like you're stressed or pressured, and they're saying, listen to me, Ron, that's not how you do it. Do this. It's 7/16 stretch. You have to remember, they're viewing from my eyes, and they can see everything I'm seeing, and they comment about that, and they misdirect 24/7. It's all misdirected, and oh my gosh, you get complication going in the head and you're so confused. But that was in the beginning, and the threats have become very, very real. And you know, I've had actual vandalism in my car where I could have hurt other people on the road from it, you know, brakes being drained, etc. So the voice to skull has some backup at night when you have to sleep. You can't watch your car all night long to make sure it's safe. So, you know, they get you to the point where every time you go into your car now, you make sure you have brake fluid and radiator fluid and the oil and this and that. Voice to skull, it's a very, if I wasn't who I am, I don't know how I would handle it. And I truly believe not too many people can. From what I understand on SyntheticTelepathy.com, they've mathematically did an equation, and from what I understand, 891 people a day take their own lives because of it.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah, you can look that up.
Well, one of the things that I found so interesting with your story was the fact that you got into this after winning a significant case against an insurance company. So can you kind of explain that in your own words?
You bet. I have something that's called degenerative disc disease. My L4, L5 disc, in between L4 and L5, was being eaten up by a disease. And I used to have my own company, very successful and stuff, but it got to a point where Ron's body could not work anymore. So I had depleted all my assets and everything, went through a divorce in that time era, and finally my body got to the point where I couldn't work. There's too much pain. It's very, very painful, bone on bone. And you have to jump through so many hoops to get to the point where I was at on DSHS to prove that, yes, you do need this, you know, last chance of insurance just to keep you going to the doctor's stuff. I received $340 a month just to have gas to go to the doctor's, I guess, is what it turns out to be. But, and I also had $200 in food stamps. About two and a half years into that system, the doctors were taking care of me. I was on a pain management system and, you know, just surviving. And one day I received a letter stating that I was going to be dropped from the system because of the Washington State budget cuts, and they just went right down the list and my name was on it. And I thought to myself, gee, that doesn't seem very fair. So being who I am, I wasn't there to raise a stink. I just wanted questions and answers. And I made a few phone calls, emails, legislature and senator and the DSHS department itself. And I believe I struck a note because probably 4 days after I did what I did, I received a call stating, congratulations, you are now in this department of the DSHS. You've been reinstated, and oh, by the way, you, along with the 1,756 people that were on that budget cut list, all are reinsured. And I'm thinking,
wow,
to myself, right on, congratulations.
Yeah.
You know, I done did good. Well, later I found out it wasn't so good. So, but I do the same thing over again. It's just the right thing to do. So,
now, how soon after winning this did you actually get targeted? How soon after this?
Oh boy, I'd say within a month, things started deteriorating rapidly around me. I am a mechanic, and I build houses. I'm jack of all trades, and all of a sudden, I couldn't seem to keep a car running. And all of a sudden, my phone bills became astronomically high. And in the beginning, you don't understand that someone could be doing this to you. You just think this is just life. And I was trying to pay these phone bills and borrowing money and keeping my car running. But when you start losing two transmissions in 3 months, something's up. And
yeah,
that's computer problems started coming into play. oven started breaking. It was so strange, all these things. And when you start realizing that something's going on, you try to explain this to the person that has no idea that there's an outside force doing this to you. It gets very, very lonely very quick because you have to keep your mouth very quiet until I figured I'll just shut up until I can start proving this stuff. So I went along with the vandalism and such and paid my phone bills and kept good track of my minutes, et cetera, et cetera. But at that time with the DSHS, in that time era, I was also told that everybody in Washington State has taken a pee test, and I had to pee in a jar. And unfortunately, I came up dirty on the pee test because I was running out of pills. And if you ever heard about heroin withdrawals, I was on Oxycontin, Vicodin, and Soma. It was so painful. And unfortunately, 3 days early, I'd run out, and I had to self-medicate, and they found a different drug in my system. And instead of, you know, giving me maybe some help, they just dropped me from the pain management. There was no help. You're done. And,
oh, dear.
Yeah. What do you do then? Well, lo and behold, I had a backhoe that I was selling, and just around that time, a man, you know, showed up at my door with $6,000 cash in his hand, and he said, I want to buy that backhoe. It was dark. He didn't even start it or anything. He just bought it, $6,000 cash, sight unseen, and left. So I had money, so I was self-medicating, unfortunately, because I couldn't find a doctor to save my life. And, you know, it wasn't that was not a good time in my life. I was set up from the get-go. We can go into the long story of how I know that, but that was part of the setup. And that's where, unfortunately, subliminal messages, those ones that you don't understand, they're not your thoughts. I ended up in ICU twice. For 3 days at a time, out like a light. And one time I remember waking up in the middle of probably a day and a half into it, I guess, was what I'm told. I remember waking up, looking down, there's a catheter in me. I pulled it out, and I look around, there's probably 8 to 10 doctors all around me. And I'm like, what the heck? And boom, I was out again. So I believe that's where the chipping and all that stuff occurred, being subliminalized in going to the ICU. It was a very strange time, and everyone who begins in this TI system, the beginning is always so confusing, so confusing. You have no idea. When you first hear a voice, that throws you off, and when all this other stuff happens, it just becomes, your whole life becomes one big confusing ball. So.
Wow. So you do feel like directly your trip to the hospital resulted in the microchips being implanted?
Oh, you bet. Oh, yeah, my V2K said you might as well take those sleeping pills you were just prescribed because the cops are on their way. And I did.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yeah, I did. They said you might as well sleep while you're in jail. And there was no cops on their way. You know, but in the beginning, you don't know what it's so strange to hear that and get, you know, again, the silent thought is your own thought. I actually hear thoughts in my own words. That's how technology is being used against a lot of people. Your thoughts are actually done in your own words also, which makes it real hard to read and watch TV because these thoughts of your own are always being subjected to is very confusing. It's very, very confusing. I know of people right now that they're just entertained by their V2K. There's nothing else in their life but their voiceless skull because they made it such that, you know, they're isolated and the V2K keeps them occupied. And they laugh, they giggle, and, you know, and, boy, it's sad to watch, but I believe there's going to be a time where we can, you know, flip that switch back off, hopefully. That's my only goal. And having two girls, that's my biggest goal. I don't ever want them to experience this. Although I know they do get the subliminals. I know they get the silent thought. They can do that to anybody. You don't need to.
Right. I think one of the scariest things about learning about this technology and actually finding out that they're up to this is the fact that this could actually put every single person in the entire, you know, world on this, this type of lab rat experiment, you know, where they're basically controlling people through their thoughts via electronic remote satellite technology and harassment. So I don't think people realize the scope of this, but when you first hear it, it's like, oh my gosh, this is sci-fi. This is not true. There's no way that this could possibly be happening. But according to all my research, this is exactly where this rabbit hole leads. This is what's going on underneath all the chemtrail things. Of course, the chemtrails are used to electromagnetize the sky, where directed energy weapons and psychotronic and cyclotronic weapons can be used on people's nervous system and via cybernetics, which is basically the term that Dr. Robert Duncan uses, which means mind control. So they're able to dial all of this in remotely with satellites. Now, one of the interesting things that I saw from your own experience was the videotape that you had at the lunch table, remember?
You
bet. You shared that with the group.
Anybody can, this is one way that anybody can verify what I'm about to tell you. I noticed in the beginning of this, there was always kind of this super bright blinking star above my house. I used to live out in the Doompuckies on a 5-acre plot. Never took really note of it. Maybe it was a planet. I don't know. But I started looking up a little bit more, and those stars started multiplying. And I decided to try to, you know, get a telescope and look a little closer at it. Well, I'd buy a telescope, and the next day it'd be broken. so, anyway, I stopped buying telescopes because I couldn't really zoom in at night. It had to be something that could see at night. And I figured, okay, how about a computer camera? Well, no, you can't do it with a computer camera because mine, well, the one I had didn't have night shot. Well, I decided to go to a secondhand store, and I go to garage sales, and I've started purchasing those old handheld 8mm cameras. You know, I have a Sony, and it has night vision. So I pointed up to the sky one night, and I can zoom in on what I can only describe is a energy ball. It's a ball of light. Now, any of us can go to the secondhand store and find one of these video cameras, and you can do that same experiment. Once you zoom in, your jaw is going to drop because these aren't stars. These are, they're not satellites either. Satellites, I did a little investigation. That's 17,000 to 22,500 miles up in the air. These balls actually can be moved with a handheld laser. I actually have a laser level, and I can move these balls. They actually move.
Wow.
I don't know if that's how they communicate them to such, but I have videotape of what appears to be, you know, Orion's belt, what appears to be the Big Dipper, and once you zoom in on them, you can tell they're not a star, and obviously your video camera or mine is not going to focus in on any star. So these are not that far from the Earth, and they actually communicate and blink, and after a while you start noticing, where are the real stars? That's the scary part. I know there was a movie made like this, and I can't make this stuff up, but and now I have roughly about 30 above my house, which is above Linwood, which is Linwood's you know, one of those places that have cameras all over the place, every intersection, et cetera. I don't know if there's any connection there, but I know these things, every night I get that same pattern of stars. It doesn't seem to change like, you know, it should. And anybody can do that experiment. $10, go buy one of those little cameras, night shot, point it towards one of those blinking stars that are very, very bright. And
yeah.
You'll see they're not.
I actually was impressed with that because, you know, I love film and I love futuristic type movies and stuff, but I've never seen anything that could morph like that, that was actually morphing in and out of shape, like literally transforming, almost as if like looking at something under a microscope, like where you see red blood cells or something dividing or some type of thing that you're seeing on a microscope. I mean, this is like a complete technology that looked to be completely alive, with like animated technology just morphing in the sky, according to what I saw on your video camera. So
you bet.
It was
I have one that turned red and blue, and it was appear that it was malfunctioning, but
mm-hmm.
they got it back together. It was falling down, and it was turning red and blue and having a little trail, but they fixed it or something, and it went back up. And oh yeah, once you start seeing, as you do, the chemtrails, you start paying attention to them. But, I mean, the stars, these things, once you start seeing them, you can't stop going out at night and looking at them. I don't do it every night, except being in Seattle. I've also caught them under clouds.
Oh.
So.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, very convincing evidence. And that's what I'm all about, is collecting evidence. Everything I do is about collecting evidence. Since I've been in court waiting for 3 years now to be able to spend the night with my child, so.
Right.
Yeah. I invite anybody to just test it. It only costs you $10 at any garage sale. These cameras are going a dime a dozen. Nobody wants them anymore because they're computer's cameras, but the computer camera can't do it. It has to be those handheld.
Cool. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that I think that you know, I'd like to just mention here, it's kind of an aside, but there are three major industries that really need to hear about this technology, I feel. One is the medical community, because doctors, nurses, emergency rooms, all of this are not going to be aware of what's going on unless we can get the word out on this. The same is true of the legal end of things, attorneys, judges, court systems, policemen. I mean, this technology is so new that the majority of people have never heard of this. Therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, a lot of the people that come in with complaints on voice-to-skull technology, the brain microwave hearing, V2K, are exhibiting and talking about symptoms that would typically be a DSM-3 disorder or 4 or 5 disorder, dealing with schizophrenia. So we're needing to catch up all of these professions, and hopefully these people are listening where we can get the word out. But these are real-to-life technologies that they're using on people. I guess, Ron, now tell me if I'm wrong, but my assumption is that these are mimicking schizophrenic reactions where people will go in, complain about it, and then will possibly get locked up basically for life. Is that true?
Oh, that's very true, and that's the goal. I have a friend that a target individual in my group. His brother was a 10-year target, and that is definitely the goal. He unfortunately was told to save Obama across the state and made the mistake, and he ended up being chased by cops, rolled the car, et cetera, et cetera. Then they ended up probably questioning him. He hears voices, et cetera, and they put him on the meds that they put anybody who would tell any medical doctor that you're hearing voices. Well, we all know that there's a pill to cure everything. Well, unfortunately, these pills manifest another disease state in your body. And he became diabetic. He's starting to have, you know, parts of his body cut off because of this.
Oh my
and
God.
He is in a total, total comatose state. I mean, he's totally just out in the wind, unfortunately. 10 years ago, he was a person like you and I, you know, making money and paying our taxes. He was just targeted for no obvious reason, we should say. But, yeah, whatever. The best advice I could give anybody is you don't tell somebody about you hear the voice. If I may, I'll tell you my little story about that. I was set up with a domestic violence against my child right in the beginning of this. And I stepped on her foot, and I got a domestic violence out of it. Well, when I had to plead guilty or non-guilty, I pled not guilty because of electronic surveillance in the beginning. I just knew something was happening with electronics. And I had to wait for an evaluation, an initial evaluation, which was 1 hour. Now, the psychiatry books, from what I understand and I read, and I believe it was on BigBrothers.com or BigBrothersWatchingUs.com, it states that the technology has to be ruled out before giving someone that diagnosis of a true schizophrenic. I went in for my initial evaluation with my lawyer, and I brought in the patents that show microwave auditory effect or synthetic telepathy, et cetera, the atmospheric sonar weapon. All of the patents, and the lady asked, the evaluator asked about voices, and I turned to my lawyer, and I said, well, do I or don't I? And he said, you brought it all, you know, lay it on the line, be truthful. And I laid it on the line, showed her all the patents, et cetera, U.S. patents, and lo and behold, I get a delusional disorder out of that. Well,
oh, man.
When you get a delusional disorder, then they delay you a little bit further and say you have to go now voluntary to have a little stay at the Western State Hospital, is our hospital of choice, you know, where the murders and rapists go, that, you know. And I went down there, and I was going to be 14 to 28 days. My initial evaluation when I went in is with a psychiatrist, a psychologist, social worker, a nurse, and a witness for the state. And the question arose, do you hear voices? And I said this. I said, now, it would be very foolish for me to answer that question honestly because I've already done so, and look where I am now.
Yeah.
And they all just kind of sat back and went, oh, wait, this guy, you know, he's all here. And I started mentioning the Freedom from Covert Harassment site, the ICA Act site, the SyntheticTelepathy.com site to them, and apparently I did such a great justice myself that I walked out of that initial evaluation without a prescription. And later on, the social worker came up to me and said, in his 15 years of working there, he's never seen anybody walk out of that room without a prescription. And
Well, you're very convincing. When I saw you on stage, I was like, good heavens, I would never want to run up against him in some type of stage audition or karaoke competition because you really rocked your stage performance. I can just imagine you in a courtroom or something. And I think that you really have the type of ability to grab hold of this concept and possibly turn it around because your testimony is so convincing in a stage setting.
Well, I'll tell you something. It's been a long road for this court thing. You know, the restraining order against your daughter is enough to break enough people just to say, okay, I plead guilty and go through the sentence. But I just knew I had to bring this out on paper. And in doing so, I've suffered, and my daughter has suffered enough, but unfortunately, after that six-day stay, the prosecutor decided maybe they made a mistake and we're going to do it again.
Now,
Yeah, and they delayed it another 8 months. Well, when you're in a mind control system, it takes time to consume the mind. And I've been trying to explain to my lawyer as, you know, gently as I can, time is of the essence. And, you know, 3 years now they've been, you know, trying to manipulate my mind and create all my thoughts, you know, out of a computer. And it's been tough, and there's been some trying times, but I just have to do what I have to do. If I don't, who will? And I just have the opportunity and maybe the ability that I can, you know, withstand some of this technology. I find myself, I'll be truthful with you, I find myself being drawn into their thought. It's, and all of a sudden you'll just shake your head and go, wait a minute, that wasn't me. amazing. The technology, we can go on and on about, you know, the visions, the hallucinations or whatever. But if you can imagine your most intimate detail being derailed and commented on and such, there is no, I'm in prison without any bars or walls right now. There's no need for judges or prisons anymore. This is it. This is the ultimate.
Wow.
There's no secrets in one's mind anymore. They got them all. And, you know, I mean, it really, really is discouraging at times. But you just got to, you know, pedal forward and fight the good fight. So.
Well, one of the most interesting conversations that I had at that seminar this past weekend was with you when we were discussing the ability that they have basically to use the human population as pets and almost amp their sex drive up or do whatever they want to get a peep into their intimate behavior. So can you kind of like go a little bit into that? I know that your speech kind of delved into that, and I was like, oh my gosh, I couldn't believe that you're actually going there. But that's what the audience needs to hear. I don't think people realize how invasive this is to people's lives without actually hearing some stories. So do you mind going there?
I have no problem. I document a lot of my torture via 911 calls, and I don't want police or ambulance or anything at that time. I just say for documentation only because I've been told to do so by another officer. At one time, I called 911 and said, right now, I'm being raped.
Oh, my gosh.
There's no one in the room. It's me, and it's done electrically. It's and it could be a chip. I don't know. I haven't gone down there to check for a chip. But, you know, I've had my penis felt like it was in a vice, burnt with a torch. I have visions of men. They're trying to almost change the sexuality. One of my gay friends are trying to change him into being straight, and they actually tried to change me into finding men sexually attractive. I just talked to another TI who explained to me about baseball bats being involved and cruel weapons of rape and torture. You can't make this up.
Right.
It's done via remote. So, and from what Robert Duncan said, somebody had to experience that in order for you to feel those sensations, and that's very scary, thinking that some scientist or whoever is recording torture on somebody, and then they can just plug it into someone else's head. It's very, very scary. With two girls, boy, I'll tell you what, they'll have to chop my legs and arms off and maybe decapitate me to make me shut up, because I don't want anybody that I know or anybody in this world to feel what I've felt myself and heard. It's just amazing technology. It's amazing, scary, and very torturous. And we should all be in fear. I'm just an ordinary person. I'm just a regular guy. I'm not a spy. I'm not a terrorist. But, boy, I'm sure tortured every day. Like, you know, they want information out of me. And you have to remember, I'm one of the ones they want me to self-destruct. Every day, day in and day out, everything will be okay if you just, you know, take your own life.
Cancel.
I don't think that's a good choice.
Cancel.
Yeah.
The thing that I also liked about what you were sharing at the lunch table was the fact that you you said that when you first had this experience that you saw lights and cameras going off like you were winning the biggest court case that had ever happened in the history of mankind. And I was like, right on, Ron. Yeah, let's go for it. We need to pull this into a court case and win it, you know?
Well, it's from what I've experienced in court so far, it seems like a lot of people are involved that are in deep. So I hope so, too. And that was very interesting. When I was driving down the road in my car when all of a sudden the first time I ever heard the voice, it said, Ron, can you hear me? And I was like, oh, technology, you got me. That was strange. How'd you do that? I'm thinking speakers and such. But as soon as I heard that voice, my two girls came into my mind thinking, oh, my God, I got to protect them. And then the next thought I had was, yeah, me walking out of a courtroom with thousands of cameras in my face questioning me, you know, about how'd you do it or what have you. But those were three things that, I mean, within a minute of hearing the voice, I already had those thoughts. And hopefully they were mine.
So, I don't think they would have given you the camera image, you know.
No,
I think that
must
have been self-generated.
What's very interesting is my voice to school just can't believe when I put my mind to something. You have to understand, they're doing everything they can to deter it. They've broken my cars before court, and I fixed them, you know, to get there. The AM Coast to Coast program, they broke my phone 5 minutes before, and I had to rewire it to get back on. And they just can't believe my ability to make things happen. Now, B2K, it gives you hope in one word, and then the next time they'll tell you to F you, you know. I mean, it brings you up, and then it brings you down. You start learning the systems that they use. So, but I'm always, always persistent. If I put my mind to something, I will do it. And they don't like that. They've done
a lot
of things.
Yeah, you're very convincing, very, very convincing. And out of everyone that spoke at that seminar, I'm a fan of Dr. Robert Duncan, but your delivery was really super outstanding and very convincing. So I think that your story is what will push this thing forward. This is a really phenomenal story, and you have the ability and you have the skill to actually get up and deliver it in a very, very believable manner, which I think is you're going to go somewhere with this. I can just feel it. So that's why I brought you on the show. Hello? Now I'm off the show. Hello, Ruthann, are you there?
Hello?
Oh, okay, he's back.
Okay, something happened there. Hello. Yeah, somebody cut right into that. Okay, what happened?
Well, it's kind of like when you dial 911 twice and you have it on video, but it doesn't connect to 911. It goes on and on. That's nothing.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not sure if people were just hearing me say hello, whatever. But anyway, we're back. This is just to be expected. I don't think that they want some of this to be aired, but your story is very convincing. And then, you know, of course, some of the things that you shared at the lunch table were also interesting. We were talking about the ability for them to supercharge people sexually where their only thought is some type of sexual contact or some type of, you know, that basically they're using people as lab rats, just super amping them in certain cases. Can you expound on that?
You sure you want me to go there?
Well, in a PG way. Say it in a
okay.
PG way.
Well, I think I explained it to you like this. At any moment in time where, you know, it happens to be the sickest one of the perps for that day wants to, you know, make you excited, he can do so. we call it the M button. It's instantaneous. And in the beginning, I couldn't believe that that could happen. And it is very embarrassing at times, sometimes very inconvenient. If you can imagine being at a baseball game and all of a sudden, you know, you have this uncontrollable urge to satisfy yourself. It's unreal. And I have asked women, and they've had that also. And I've actually talked to another gentleman who he didn't even have to touch himself and, you know, fire rockets went off or what have you. I'm trying to make it as PG as I possibly can. And you, the reason why that's a good question, because they can make anybody get to that point. And if you don't understand it, you will probably end up having to relieve that. And there, if there's a, you know, unfortunate person right next to you and you're alone, you might have to do that. And all of a sudden you have a crime against you.
That's
the scary part. Oh, you bet. That's the scariest part.
Wow.
And you wonder how many people are in jail because of that technology. You know, setting somebody up with that would be just terrible. And it's the uncontrollable urge. You have to handle that. I mean, and in the beginning, it was 8-10 times a day. No joke. And it's just right now. It's just a button on a computer. That's all it is.
So it's like super amping your libido, basically?
From what I understand, it's a 6.25 wavelength.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It super amplifies. I mean, it's now. You don't even have to think twice. And, you know, it's one of those things where you have to question a lot of people who've just done things out of character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's technology could be answering a lot of these questions from what I understand. Again, when I was in Western State, I met four people that are TIs. Unfortunately, they made the mistake. And if you meet four people that are in Western State because they heard a voice to skull, you wonder how many people are in jail because they heard a voice to skull or had a subliminal or had the, you know, the masturbator button pushed on them and they did a mistake. You know, there's probably a lot of people framed and bribed and what have you with this stuff. They can see through your eyes. They can hear all you hear, read your mind, manipulate it. You just have to wonder how many people are crucified or, you know, in jail for the next 15 years because of this or being bribed because of it.
Right. Now, when you say that people are able to see out of your eyes, from my perspective and what I've gathered with my research, the nanobot technology that we're all breathing in from chemtrails basically is infused within the human body. So it basically becomes a part of your own DNA and becomes active in your body. And according to what I have pieced together, it's almost as if these nanobots can then be pulled directly to your eye through some type of laser beam technology where it almost magnetizes a camera-like device that goes into the back of the eye and basically opens your eyes up to becoming a total spy machine, almost like, you know, you become a robot and your eyes become a recording device. Is that kind of how you would describe this, Ron?
Well, what I understood is there's a program someone developed that can read your vision and put it into a vision on a screen. They read the vision, you know. But in my past 3 years, I've had a red dot that magically appeared at the time that this started for me, right in the my left eye. It's just a little red dot, which I was told is a mole, by the way, recently. By an eye doctor, and that thing wasn't there before this started, but it sure has been there the whole time during this, and that's what I thought the camera was. Now, I talked to a super soldier down there, and he says his is actually in the back of his eye, and you shine a light into it, you could see it, but I didn't go that far. But from what I understood, there is a program some scientists has developed that reads your vision, and then it redistributes that to, you know, a picture on a screen.
Wow.
That's how I understand it. And, yeah, if it is nanobots, we all have those nanobots since they've been spraying the world. So we're all video cameras, so we're all being monitored through our, you know, our iPhone, computer, all that stuff. And it's all to gather information. For what reason, I don't know. Why is your life or my life so interesting? I don't know. I believe, you know, it's for someone, 70-year-old man out there who, you know, has a bunch of money and, you know, wants to watch some, you know, two people have an intimate time. And that's the worst part. A lot of this is your intimacy is gone. It's what you realize they're watching through your eyes or what have you, reading your vision or whatever. That part's really tough to get over. So, you get into the eyeballs. I happened to be intimate with my friend one day, and I opened my eyeballs, and there was my daughter's face on her.
Oh, dear.
And, boy, I'll tell you what, if that's not disturbing, I don't know what is. And, you know, in the beginning of this, you know, I chased three men through the woods that weren't even there, you know, and recently I've been seeing these crafts and aliens and as you go farther and farther into this, it just becomes stranger and stranger, and it's all to make, you know, one mind, I believe the mind, to pop finally, and you just got to be strong. I mean, I know that alien's not talking to me, and he's not really there, you know. So
we've got like about 3.5 minutes, Ron. Can you explain briefly about the holographic images that you feel like you've seen? Because you and I had that conversation last night as we were scheduling. So can you share that with my audience?
Oh, you bet. I've seen the most detailed UFOs that Star Trek doesn't do what I've seen justice. I've seen the most detailed, ugliest, scariest aliens. And they actually turn their heads and look at me, and they communicate, you know, if you want to. And they're definitely a hologram. And it's not all the time, but it's one of those things where, again, if you're not a strong person and you're seeing, you know, the scariest alien rip open a man's chest and, you know, rip out his tongue with his teeth, you're going to snap. And from what I understand, that those might be our next terrorists, so maybe a little heads up, the aliens, in my vision, are not real. So
right.
These are very, very detailed. And they're like superimposed on objects and stuff. It's very strange. I couldn't even begin to explain what to, you know, watch on TV to match up what I've seen.
Well, Project Bluebeam, if you, you know, for my audience, if they want to Google that on YouTube, there's several videos about Project Bluebeam. But this technology with the psychotronic and cyclotronic weapons seems to be going even more from the person's mind, like projecting outward rather than just seeing some type of projection that appears to be like a 3D movie happening in real life. So from what you and I discussed last night, it seems like you were saying that this is like in your mind, but it appears like there's actually a real image out there that's holographic. Is that true?
Well, you know, I mean, even one step further, I mean, I was viewing it out my window one night. I actually watched an alien war, and I saw soldiers walking in and being split in half and then dragging half their body back, you know, whimpering and stuff. And I took a pair of binoculars, and I got close up to them. And
whoa.
I mean, okay, you explain that to me. If you could take a pair of binoculars and you get up close and you watch this gorilla-like superhuman thing, you know, being electrocuted by a laser, you know, just, we're in a technological time warp. I can't explain what I've seen and do it justice. It's, if this was at Disneyland, it would be the most popular ride in the world.
yeah.
I'm telling you, it's amazing. It's more than 3D. It's like you're there viewing it. And again, I'm pretty much, I have to touch it, feel it to believe it. And when you know it's not real, I just sit back and I do the details on it. I want to view it and I kind of delay it and just, I want details and I want to, I try to, you know, project where the shadows are and stuff and see if they've been illuminated.
For coming on, this is astonishing. And thank you as always, but our time is up, guys.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much, Ruth Ann. Thank you for letting us do this type of show. I appreciate it. Ron, thank you so much, and I hope to have you on the show again. So
I'd love
keep
to.
In touch. Yeah, I'd love
I'd
to have
love
you back
to.
On. Very good.
No problem.
Thank you so much. You'll have a good night.
Thank you for having me.
Happy Memorial Day to everybody. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.